Back. Our next case is United States v. Perina Ramcharan. Mr. Kassar, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Colonel Talcott, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Very well. Mr. Kassar, please proceed.
Thank you. Having listened to a couple of arguments recently, I'll remember to stand closer to the microphone.
It will be much appreciated.
I will do my best, Judge. Your Honors, this case, my name is William Kassar, and along with Captain, whose name escapes me right now because I'm just having a complete senior moment, Kozik. We represent the appellant in this case, Lieutenant Ramarino Patron. This case is about a scrivener's error in a statute and what impact that has on the TJAG's authority to review a case and CCA jurisdiction. Put another way, this case is about whether the amended statute expanded the opportunity for appellate review to cases with sub-jurisdictional sentences, or whether these cases are entitled only to a cursory review by a judge advocate in the field. Did Congress specifically exclude sub-jurisdictional cases from appellate review? The text of 10 U.S.C. 869 C1A and C2 states that sub-jurisdictional cases get only a review by a judge advocate. There is zero evidence that Congress intended to limit the rights of convicted service members who receive a sub-jurisdictional sentence. All the evidence is to the contrary. And in fact, as Judge Bart stated in Randolph versus HV, it is generally understood that when Congress seeks to divest jurisdiction or courts or to seeks to divest jurisdiction of courts or other tribunals, it does so with a clear statement. In United States versus McPherson.
Mr. Kassar, before
yes, Your Honor.
We get to the practical aspects of the case,
yes, sir.
I'd like to explore with you a little bit the theoretical underpinnings here. And specifically, in your view, how is this court to conceive of the concept of Scrivener's error doctrine, or perhaps it should be less formal and simply referred to as Scrivener's error approach? Is this Scrivener's error approach or doctrine derivative of the absurdity doctrine, where this court needs to apply the principles of the absurdity doctrine and the Scrivener's error is an explanation for it? Or does the Scrivener's error doctrine or approach stand separate and apart from that? And if so, what are the principles that a court needs to apply to determine when it is appropriate to invoke the Scrivener's error doctrine or approach?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think we look at a couple of different things. The first is, the direct answer to your question, Judge, is I think that they are analogous. And if you look at the Supreme Court decision in something trucking, the trucking company case, that where SCOTUS says, the Eighth Circuit, I believe it is, dealt with the exact issue, and they said, if, for example, a court were to say that it is lawful to traffic in child pornography, a statute rather said it is lawful to traffic in child pornography, well, obviously, everybody reading that statute would know intuitively that what they mean is it is unlawful, and that is a Scrivener's error. I think that in order to reach that conclusion, what the court needs to do is to look at the cases applying the absurdity doctrine, and you can analogize from there, what do we do? And I think that this court can do a couple of things. And the first one is, as we do in this case, is look at, well, where does this appear in the bigger picture of the statute? How do we determine if this is a Scrivener's error? Analogy to the absurdity doctrine, you look to where does this appear in the bigger picture of the statute. For example I just gave you, if the header said lawfulness or unlawfulness of child pornography, and then in the text it said it is lawful to traffic in child pornography, in addition to just the absurdity of that statement, one would say, but it's obviously in the subsection that says it is unlawful.
So let's tease that out a little bit. We're dealing with a situation where invoking the Scrivener's error doctrine or approach could be a nuclear weapon in the pocket of a court. We've got a situation where there isn't ambiguity in the language where a court is trying to interpret what Congress meant. The language is plain. It's not gibberish. And so what are the parameters in terms of when a court may invoke that? So there couldn't be situations where it would be obvious to any rational person that there is an error, such as an example would be if in legislation it were to say that the winning party should have to pay the fees. And everybody would say, well, they meant to say the losing party. But when we have to start getting into congressional intent, what does the record say? How does a court then say, if it's divorced from the absurdity doctrine, which has this extremely high standard, saying it really has to shock the moral or common sense before we can invoke it, why shouldn't that same standard apply before we invoke the Scrivener's error doctrine or approach?
Two things, Judge. One, I'm saying that it is analogous. I'm not saying that we disregard the absurdity doctrine or that we ignore the absurdity doctrine. I do believe that they are analogous and that we can use some of the cases that discuss the absurdity doctrine along with those cases that discuss the Scrivener's error doctrine. And two, it's not necessarily a question, it is not a question of whether you look at the statute and say, well, that's absurd. The impact of the statute is also something that is considered. What is the effect of the statute as written? So, for example, in our case, getting back to the nuts and bolts of our case for just a minute, the impact of the statute is absurd. So you look at two different, we point out three different things, but looking at two of those for a minute, you look at it in the header of the bigger statute, where the statute says, this is what we're trying to do, and then the text does the exact opposite. And then you look at what is the result of that Scrivener's error, and you say, well, the result is absurd. Why is it absurd? Because in this case, it leads to A, summary court-martial convictions getting more thorough and more robust of a review than somebody in appellant's case.
So, in writing this opinion, let's say that the opinion was intended to be consistent with your approach. What would this court write in terms of the answer to the following question? A court properly invokes the Scrivener's error doctrine or the Scrivener's approach when, what's the rest of the statement?
When Mr. Cacera advocates for it. No. I think the first thing that you look for, Judge, is you say when the result of the Scrivener's error, as written, would lead to an absurd result.
So we as a court not only get to say that it's absurd, but we get to say Congress doesn't have the authority to do absurd things in legislation?
No. When my hand was up in the air, the next one was going to be two, or when, and consistent with United States v. McPherson from this court, when the result would clearly thwart congressional intent. And that is when, an analogous to the absurdity cases, and I know that there was some question in Avery and some other cases about congressional history versus congressional intent, and we can talk about that if the court desires, but for our purposes, the congressional intent is absolutely clear. We don't have to look towards any congressional debate. We don't have to look towards what did Congress mean? We know what Congress meant. Why? Because they told us so.
So in terms of the interplay between the Scrivener's error doctrine or approach and the absurdity doctrine, would you agree or disagree that in order for a court to invoke the Scrivener's error, that the result would have to shock the moral or common sense?
No, I would disagree, Judge, because there are certainly going to be cases. I mean, for example, a typo. I mean, a typo is a Scrivener's error. If there is a typo and somebody puts an E in instead of an A, this court can say, well, there's obviously a Scrivener's error, but it's irrelevant and it doesn't impact the case, but they can still, this court still has obviously the authority to make a pronouncement that there is a Scrivener's error. I'm looking at the expression on your face, Judge, and I'm getting the feeling that's not the question you wanted me to answer.
I'm still trying to get to the point that there is a clear principle about when a court can do this. As I said, this is a nuclear weapon in the pocket of a court to say there is plain language in legislation, and we are going to decide, no, Congress, what you passed isn't what we are going to say this plain language says. There is that very high hurdle in the absurdity doctrine. It has to shock the moral or common sense people. You're not incorporating that into the application of the Scrivener's error doctrine or approach. I'm just wondering, is there any other principle that you're applying that would ensure that this principle is not abused by a court?
Absolutely, Judge. And again, I think that you can look towards the three areas that we put in our brief. I've discussed two of them. Where does it stand in the bigger picture of the statute? What is the result of that? And then three is, what did Congress clearly intend? And what Congress clearly intended, we don't have to look at this case and say, what, you know, did Congress intend, for example, to give summary court-martial convictions a higher standard of review than people in appellant's case? And we would say no to that because, A, it would be absurd, and, B, we have the congressional history and the congressional intent very specifically stated out for us. So it's not that this court would then have the authority to say, well, we simply disagree with Congress. No, that's what McPherson specifically says that this court should not do. The question isn't how do we determine whether or not we are thwarting Congress's desires. And I think that's the question the Chief Judge is asking me. The question is, what application is necessary in order to specifically carry out what we know Congress intended? Because otherwise, the nuclear option would be, as in the example I gave previously, if Congress were to miswrite child pornography is lawful instead of unlawful, the absurd result of that is, and the nuclear option is, that people peddling in child pornography do not get prosecuted until somebody or some court says, well, obviously that's a typo. And so if the court's concerned about a nuclear option, that's the nuclear result.
Why doesn't that approach fly in the face of the majority opinion in McPherson?
Because McPherson specifically states, this court told us how to determine whether a statute, and again, this was the ambiguity and the absurdity doctrine in McPherson. And this court said whether statutory language is ambiguous is determined by reference to the language itself, the specific context in which the language is used, and the broader context of the statute as a whole. When a party contends that there is an ambiguity and additional statutory interpretation is necessary, this court considers the ambiguity doctrine within the larger legislation and the starting point to determine legislative intent. In other words, the difference between that and this is, or in the court's hypothetical, is what McPherson tells us is not to thwart congressional intent. What appellant is saying is absolutely. And how do we know that? What is congressional intent? The congressional intent is that people in his category get a more robust appellate review than they previously got. And we know that because, A, we all have the legislative history, and we have the three things that I told you about. And B, as Judge Sparks said, if it was the opposite, if Congress specifically intended to limit jurisdiction, they would have told us so. So that's how we know it. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, thank you. I don't want to run out of time. The our issue, the granted issue, is whether the Judge Advocate General and the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals lack jurisdiction to review appellant's case.
Yes, ma'am.
In the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals in Zaire, took a different approach. Instead of trying to go down the rabbit hole of 65 Bravo, 65 Delta, 69, they looked at the jurisdictional provisions and concluded that based upon the jurisdictional provisions, TJAG had authority to review this. And by virtue of the fact that the appellant applied to the CCA, they had jurisdiction. What should we make of that argument? Should this court follow that approach in Zaire and just skirt the 69 Bravo 65 Charlie 60, argument?
If you're asking to follow up on the Chief Judge's question, what this court's opinion should say, if the court agrees with appellant's position, because of the number of cases that are undoubtedly still in the pipeline, appellant believes that it would be a better course of action for this court to say it's clear that the statute has a Scrivener's error.
Okay.
Counsel,
I'm sorry, Judge. Was that your question?
No, that's fine. Okay. I
just wanted
have
to make
a clear,
sure.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
What is it appellant wants us to do? You trying to get to the call of the question, or you want us to resolve the conflict in the provision?
Okay. Thank you, ma'am.
Counsel, the military justice system has the benefit that the Senate in the NDAA amends the UCMJ every year. Should that affect our error correction attitude towards the UCMJ in the sense that if this is a mistake, they can fix it, and they probably will?
I'm sure they will. However, there are still cases that are in the pipeline, not just appellants, who rely upon the decision of this court to, and again, going back to Judge Jackson's question, there's sort of the underlying issue that we originally raised to this court and the issue that the court granted on. In order for this court to get to the underlying issue, they have to consider this case for the appellant and determine that the CCA had authority and that, or that the CCA had jurisdiction and the TJAG had authority. So, no, I don't believe it would be appropriate to simply say, there's, we'll wait until Congress decided, and Anderson notwithstanding, which is still.
Thank you.
Subject to any further questions from the members of the court?
Questions from the bench?
Thank you, Mr.
Judge. Colonel Talcott.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, I'm Colonel Matthew Talcott, and along with Ms. Marilyn Payne, I represent the government. Today, the government's going to ask this court to find that it has no jurisdiction to review appellant's case. And we're going to do so for one principal reason, the plain language of the statute. Article 69D says that the CCA can only review cases that have been reviewed under Article 69C. There is simply nothing in Article 69C that discusses a case like Lieutenant Perino Ramcharan's case. The Air Force Court in Zier failed to address this language in any way or any fashion at all, and this is one of the first ways they fundamentally erred. The second was that instead of wrestling with the plain language of the statute, the Air Force Court in Zier, which did analyze this issue, started with legislative history rather than the plain language of the statute. This court has repeatedly urged the CCAs and trial courts to start with the plain language. If the meaning is clear and ambiguous, that is where you end. And that is what the Air Force Court should have done in both this case and in Zier. And this court should be comfortable relying on the plain language of the statute and finding it has no jurisdiction to review this case. Judge Olson, on occasion, you will ask litigants before you, what is the message this court should send to the field, or what is the message our holding will have? Here, that message is extremely important. There are a number of legislative changes that have been made to the UCMJ. As Judge Max pointed out, there are legislative changes to the UCMJ almost every year. And our trial judges, our defense counsel, our trial counsel, our CCA struggle with the interpretation of those statutes. This court has the opportunity to affirmatively and decisively say, when you're making that struggle to interpret those statutes, do not wade into the dangerous waters of legislative history. Commit yourself to the plain language of the statute. If the plain language is unambiguous, you must follow the plain language of the statute. Turning to some of the points made by appellant, Judge Olson, you ask, how is the Scribner's error or the Scribner's approach, how, if at all, does that connect with the doctrine of absurdity? And appellant's counsel said something to the effect of they're analogous, and to that I would disagree. I say they're directly linked. That is, you must have both before the court has the authority to rewrite the statute. In this case, appellant's position is essentially rewrite the statute. We wish it was a D, it's a B. We want you to substitute D for B. Rewrite the statute. You cannot do that unless you conclude there's both a clerical or drafting error and the result of that clerical or drafting error is an absurdity. Putting this to test.
Can I ask you a specific question about the statute? So in the appropriate version of Article 69, what does provision C2 do?
Yes, Your Honor. C2 is a curious provision. And the government's position, C1 and C2, operate in turn. And so C2 essentially instructs the TJAG, when reviewing waiver cases under Article 65B, you must start with the determination, was the waiver or the withdrawal invalid? Once you've concluded the waiver withdrawal is invalid, TJAG then conducts the review. You might have thought, or I thought as I read the statute initially, if the waiver of Article 66 is invalid, doesn't it go to the CCA? But it doesn't. In fact, TJAG is the one then empowered to do the review. So the next step is, well, how does he do that review? And that's why we have C1. And I agree, if the court looks at it, it is peculiar that C2 is the first step and C1 is the second step, and that doesn't seem like the way you draft a statute ideally. There are at least two reasons I think this court should read it that way. One is the court had to address the review for Article 64 cases, that is summary court-martial. 64 comes before 65, so perhaps that's what Congress intended. The other important statute or canon of interpretation I think can guide this court is the doctrine of harmonious interpretation. That is, the court should strive to read statutes to be compatible with themselves and not contradictory. And one option that would make the statute compatible with itself is to think of C2 as step one and C1 as step two, even though I can see that it is a peculiar way to start with step two as step one, and then proceed to one as step two. I would say on top of that, that incongruity, this court doesn't actually have to address in this case. Appellant's case is a 65D case. It's not a waiver case. TJAG never should have reviewed it and didn't have authority to review it. Only an attorney in his office under 65D review. Back to Judge Olson's question about theoretical or Scrivener's error, the hypotheticals that the court discussed or that appellant brought up, I think, highlight exactly how this rule is meant to work. A statute that says it's lawful to traffic in child porn, this court would have no difficulty determining that's a Scrivener's error and no difficulty in determining that's absurd results. That offends common sense and any sense of morals. The other example, the winning party has to pay the attorney's fees. This court could quickly determine that's a drafting error or a clerical error, and then could move to the next step and say that conclusively offends all common sense. The example appellant gave, which is the misspelled third, right? We have third spelled with an A. This court might be tempted to conclude there is no third option. Congress only wrote a third option. We don't know what to do. This court could quickly determine, no, that's a clerical error, and it offends all common sense to say there's no third option. Third is meant to be third. The test is actually pretty straightforward. The Supreme Court has applied it numerous occasions. This court articulated it well. In fact, although it's the dissent, I think the dissent articulates, although it was in the context of drafting errors, but I think for practical purposes they're similar to Scrivener's errors, in the dissent in McPherson. I think taking a step back from this, McPherson is a great starting and ending point, really, for this court's analysis of this particular case. I think of the cases almost as mirror images. I mean, I'm up here for the government arguing for plain language, and in McPherson, obviously, it was the appellant arguing for the plain language, but the law works the same either way. In McPherson, this court said, we see no reason to doubt the government's theory about what Congress is attempting to accomplish. This court could start the opinion that exact same way, but say, appellant's theory. In revising the definition of child abuse offense, in revising Article 69. If that is what happened, then Congress made a substantive oversight in drafting the statute. We can recognize this kind of mistake in statutory drafting occurred, but we cannot take upon ourselves the task of rewriting the statute. That could literally be the beginning and the ending of the opinion that you issue in this case. The cases are so similar in that particular respect. And it may be worthwhile just to take a step back and say, in McPherson, the absurdity arguments were much stronger, and this Court still rejected them. In McPherson, Congress appeared to be lengthening the statute of limitations to make it easier to prosecute child victims of sex predators by saying it was going to be the life of the child plus 10 years. In doing so, though, they removed the statute of limitations that extended it for Article 134, indecent acts with the child, and shortened it to only 5 years. And so the Court struggled with, is that absurd or is that not absurd? And the Court ultimately concluded, no, it's not whether the 114th Congress personally intended to do this. The question is, could any rational Congress have made this determination? And the Court concluded a rational Congress could have decided to do that. Just as in this case, a rational Congress could have determined that sub-jurisdictional cases, such as the appellants, it's a $2,000 fine and a reprimand, don't need a third review. That is, the court-martial and a review from an attorney, they don't need then also to have a TJAG review.
Counsel, what about appellant's point that it just seems a little odd that they give a summary court-martial more review?
Yeah, Your Honor, I have two responses with regard to that, and I agree. It is curious why summary courts get such thorough review. What I'll say to that is one potential answer is summary courts don't have a military judge. So when Congress looked over the different types of court-martials that militaries had, they might have thought the court-martial without a judge might be ripe with more legal errors and deserving of a more thorough review. Compounding upon this argument is the fact that TJAC has always had, upon application, the authority to review summary courts. So if you go back to the previous version of Article 69, TJAC could review summary court-martials upon application. This particular version of Article 69, TJAC can review. And if you go even to the one that's in place now, the current version of Article 69, TJAC still retains the authority upon application to review summary courts-martials. So it's actually consistent throughout that summary court-martials have gotten this additional review. If there are no further questions from the Court.
I have a question.
Yes, of course, Your Honor.
Appellant in his brief states that the government has repeatedly conceded that, in fact, Article 69 contains a Scrivener's error when it comes to internal reference to Article 65B, and says you can't escape that now. What is your response?
Your Honor, you're right. Appellant does say that multiple times. I think what the government was saying, it's potential there was a drafting error. It's potential there's a clerical error. In thinking in terms of legislative history, I'm reminded, and this is paraphrasing this Court's own language, when thinking in terms of legislative history, it often becomes sort of this exercise in looking at a crowd of people and picking out your friends. And there definitely are friends for appellant here about what Congress might have intended to draft. And we can't know if it was a clerical error or a Scrivener's error, and we certainly concede that. We would also, though, highlight, as I have, that's not the beginning or the end of the analysis. It must have also been absurd. I would also say there are friends for the government. It's not all for the – if the Court decides to weigh into legislative history to figure out what did Congress really want to do here, once the House bill is introduced, in keeping in mind there are seven different versions of the National Defense Authorization Act of 2017, once the House bill is introduced, the very next version – has the language the government likes, the 65B, 65B parallel references in C1 and C2. The conference report issued by the Senate Armed Services Committee and the House Armed Services Committee has the correct language, B and B. And, of course, the actual statute has the B and the B. So there are multiple ways to look at this. My final answer on the government's concession regarding the statute, I would say perhaps fortunately, the parties are not allowed to stipulate as to the interpretation of the law and what a statute is. The Court is actually the only arbiter that gets to decide what the statute means.
Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, did you have anything to conclude with?
Nothing further. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Colonel Talcott. Mr. Cassera.
Thank you, Judge. Just a couple of points. Appley says that we should send a message to the field. I'm not sure what that message would be. Would that message be, if you are convicted at a summary court-martial, which is not a criminal conviction, you have more rights than somebody who is convicted at a general court-martial for something that could, A, be labeled a felony, B, put you on a sex offender registry, or any one of a number of collateral consequences? That is not a message that this court wants to send to the field. Perhaps the message that this court wants to send to the field is, when you look in the field being CCAs in this case, when you look at a statute and it is clear to everybody that the statute contains a drafting error, and as a result of that drafting error, it leads to an absurd result, this court has not only the authority, but the obligation to correct that and to say to the field, no, what obviously this statute means is that child pornography is unlawful. What obviously this statute means is that somebody in appellant's position who has been convicted at a general court-martial has more rights than somebody who has been convicted at a summary court-martial. That somebody who has the potential lifelong consequences of a general court-martial, and I'm reminded, Judge Hardy, of our discussion in the Warda cases about, in the Warda case, about the impact of a court-martial conviction. When somebody suffers the lifelong consequences of a court-martial conviction, they get more than a cursory review. What this all leads us back to, judges, and I think there is a lot of agreement in this case, and part of that agreement is there seems to be an agreement that there was a Scrivener's error. The second part of that seems to be that if a Scrivener's error leads to an absurd result, that is one of the things that this court can and should take into consideration. That's exactly what we have here. There would be no reason for Congress to say, review by courts of criminal appeal in the section header, and then put underneath it, there is no review by courts of criminal appeals. That would be absurd. Based on all those reasons, and one more thing, Judge, I realize I got 37 seconds. I realize that part of the question here is we've never addressed the underlying issue. So in anticipating a question that I may not get about what do we think the court should do, obviously this court, if they agree with the appellant as to the jurisdictional issue, can order further briefing on the underlying issue. They could decide whether to grant a subsequent review on the underlying issue or decide the case based on the briefs themselves. Seeing no further questions from the members of the court,
I have one question, Chief. Mr. Cassera, is there a difference between, or maybe they're synonymous terms, between something that maybe offends common sense and something that is absurd? And the only reason why I ask is because the term common sense seems to suggest, or at least to me sometimes, that it isn't as common as its reputation purports, but so I ask you.
I've made similar jokes in the past. The common sense is probably something that in my household you wouldn't hear uttered towards me, except for maybe in the negative. But I think that, and I think your question, we're comparing the terms common sense and absurd.
Yes.
I think
something that is maybe offends common sense, so to speak. Is it necessarily absurd? Must it be?
Must they be? Well, I always hate to speak in generalizations. I always hate to speak in generalizations. I generally hate to speak in generalizations. So I'm not sure that it must be, but certainly in this case, it offends common sense because it leads to an absurd result.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cassera.
Thank you, Judge.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise. The court stands adjourned until further order of the court.